With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, Valley citrus growers are preparing for the 2023 frost season, and concerns about how regenerative agriculture will be defined by California. But our top story today, the California Farm Bureau President, Jamie Johansen, is calling on lawmakers to work to sustain agriculture well into the future by securing water supplies and rejecting policies that ask farmers and ranchers to be resilient in the face of unaddressed challenges. Speaking before the 105th annual meeting of the California Farm Bureau in Reno, Johansen outlined, quote, extraordinary events that have put all California farmers and ranchers at risk. He noted the impacts of a three-year drought that resulted in the fallowing of more than 1.2 million acres of productive farmland. That was then followed this year by atmospheric river storms and destructive floods that caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to California farmland and crops. Johansen also took issue with California's failure to complete long-planned water infrastructure projects that could have stored water for dry years and enhanced flood control in wet ones. He said farmers and ranchers need supportive policies rooted in science, not politics. In this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA, growers are taking some action on their dormancy programs. Here's Brian German.
In today's Almond Matters segment, we're joined again by Todd Berchtold this morning. He's a field market development specialist with Valent USA. And Todd, we've hit the first week of December. The new year will be here soon. And so with the cold weather finally starting to set in, what are growers keeping top of mind out there?
Well, as fall is definitely upon us, you know, winter's only, 21st of December. So leaves are starting to fall off. You know, what we need is really a good frost, and then they'll all fall off at once. But this is a good time to think about sanitation. Okay, that this last year, navel orangeworm was a problem, I think, across the board from north to south, depending on where you're at, depending on the tactics as far as management of that pest goes. I saw fields where, even with mating disruption and conventional insecticide sprays, there was still a higher percentage of infected nuts at harvest than what's desirable. So anyway, that was kind of disappointing for several people because they took a pretty concerted effort at tackling the problem. I don't know what to think about this, Brian, but I do know that the pest itself is overwintering in mummy nuts, and so there's two ways to tackle that. You can either knock the nuts off the ground and then work them in the ground, shred them up, you know, and work them into the soil. Or you could go after them on the tree with this insecticide application. The first option is probably the most, if it's done effectively, knocking every nut off the tree. But it's also labor intensive because typically you have to use people, crews, labor to pull. So spraying is definitely probably a cheaper option. The problem with spraying is because you don't get if the overwintering larvae are inside the nut, it's hard to get the product, no matter what it is, into the nut itself, and through the shell, through the hull. Typically, they're mummied nuts, so they're hardened off. But you can do it. I mean, you put oil with it, oil application with. Typically used to be chlorpyrifos, Lorsban, that's gone. So I recommend Asana. It's probably the longest lasting of all the pyrethroids. It's got residual where others, you know, are there and gone. Asana sticks around, 5 to 6 days, especially in the wintertime when you don't have the sunlight effect as much as you would in the other times of the year. So it does last longer. Mixing it with oil. Acts as a penetrant to get into the nuts, onto the bark, wherever the larva may be overwintering. It's broad spectrum, so it's not just navel orangeworm, it's other pests as well as beneficials. So it knocks out basically everything. But it's one of those start clean, stay clean options that does work.
And we've talked before about the level of damage that growers experienced with pests this year. And might that prompt some growers to maybe get more aggressive with preventative approaches?
I mean, everybody would like to do everything they can do, I think, for the most part. you look at the economics right now, almond prices are down. The cost of anything has gone up. Crop protection products have taken a bump in a price. Labor's up. Diesel fuel's still, you know, probably around over $5 a gallon to the farm gate. You know, the cost of doing business is gone higher. So, you know, you're talking about putting an application on dormant-wise. When you really don't see the past, you know, it's for people who haven't done it for a while, it's a hard pill to swallow to spend that money. But I think that it's money well spent. You're basically, again, you're giving that ounce of prevention versus the pound of cure later on. Timely application is key. I like to do it right around this time of year. You know, right after Thanksgiving is when I recommend getting it on. You can get some uptake with your foliar nutrition, and then definitely knock out spores of overwintering fungi. You know, I've seen the benefits of it more than the cost. It is a cost. It is something. And if you're watching your cost, you know, trying to keep it down, I still think that a dormant application is very cost wise. It's probably a good application to do.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, several sources within USDA's Rural Development Mission area are providing resources to make our nation's supply chains more resilient. Rod Bain reports.
One of the tasks associated with the White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience.
I'm charging this group to ensure that our supply chains remain secure, diversified, resilient.
President Joe Biden at the recent inaugural meeting of the council, which has among its members Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. USDA investments in supply chain resiliency in the past 3 years include almost $200 million in 185 projects nationwide. Much of that comes within the Rural Development Mission area, with five specific programs fostering that investment. Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Karama Neal offers examples of how these investments look on the ground level. Rural business development grants provide resources for training and technical assistance.
An example is a $30,000 grant to the Welcome Home Organization in Michigan. Their grant is being used to conduct a feasibility study and an engineering study for a business incubator, food hub, and commercial kitchen in Jackson, Michigan. Projects that include a general store, grocery, kitchen, and small business incubator, and will feature products from local producers.
Value-added producer grants through rural development and the Agricultural Marketing Service increase revenue opportunities for producers in making their goods value added.
An example includes a $250,000 grant to Mill Creek Farms in Georgia. Their investment is going to be used for working capital to process pecan nut crops into packaged pecan products in the form of shelled, roasted, candied, and white chocolate pecans.
Affordable financing options for entrepreneurial projects as provided by commercial lenders is part of Rural Development Business and Industry Loan Guarantees. An example of such a project.
The Georgia Solar in Vermont is using a loan guarantee to finance their solar farm. Their project is expected to produce enough energy to power the equivalent of 88 homes for 1 year.
The Rural Economic Development Loan and Grant Program, REDLEG, provides zero interest loans to local utilities who lend monies to rural businesses. One program no longer available for application, the Food Supply Chain Guaranteed Loan Program. Among the recipients,
the Lone Star Bakery in Texas is a third-generation family-owned business that's using their $40 million food supply chain guaranteed loan to modernize their facilities so that they can serve customers now and in the future.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, last week, U.S. Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama and Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma, along with other Republican senators, introduced the Black Vulture Relief Act to allow farmers and ranchers to protect their newborn livestock from black vultures without burdensome government interference. The legislation provides regulatory relief by allowing farmers and ranchers to take black vultures anytime the birds threaten their livestock without a depredation permit. Currently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service operates a pilot program that allows state entities to register for a master permit and disperse sub-permits to livestock producers to safely depopulate black vultures. This practice, however, creates a patchwork of state regulations, whereas a federal permit program would streamline program ease and transparency for producers. Black vultures pose a huge threat to our livestock farmers and producers, said Senator Tuberville. Government red tape is preventing farmers from protecting newborn calves and growing their herd. Our producers need a larger, more comprehensive approach to removing these predators. This bill will provide much-needed relief and security to our nation's cattlemen. Despite being listed as a species of lowest conservation concern, black vultures are still protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, making it illegal to take one without a depredation permit from FWS. The current pilot program that allows state entities to register for a master permit and disperse sub-permits to ranchers limits the sub-permittee rancher to take only 3 to 5 black vultures per year, even though attacks normally involve 20-plus black vultures at a time. The black vulture population in the United States has increased by 468% since 1990. Black vultures are now known to attack livestock, especially calves, costing ranchers an average of $2,000 per calf killed. The Black Vulture Relief Act would maintain protections for the species by requiring annual reporting of takes to ensure FWS receives accurate data to monitor the population, and by prohibiting the use of poison as a method of take. In other livestock news, the Bezos Earth Fund, backed by e-commerce billionaire Jeff Bezos, is investing $30 million towards making livestock more sustainable. Working with Global Methane Hub's Enteric Methane R&D Accelerator, the Bezos Earth Fund is investing in a range of innovations to reduce methane emissions from livestock by as much as 30% in the next 10 to 15 years. Through an award process, the Bezos Earth Fund looks to support additional grants by providing funding to identify and develop low-methane feed, low-methane cattle breeding, and using a wearable sensor to measure cow methane emissions. The investment announcement was made in Dubai at COP28 as part of a $57 million set aside for food-related grants. The larger $57 million announcement is part of Bezos Earth Fund's food portfolio, aimed at developing low-cost virtual fencing, promoting alternative proteins, and encouraging plant-rich diets. Other projects include updating best livestock and agricultural practices and breeding next-generation low-methane cows. For Agnet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
California Citrus Mutual reminds San Joaquin Valley growers that the 2023 frost season is upon us. CCM President and CEO Casey Kramer reminds industry members that while cold temperatures can have a positive impact on the fruit and the trees, long periods of time with below freezing temperatures create concerns about potentially damaging the crop. CCM reminds industry members about their Weather Watch program to help growers navigate the frost season. Over 25 weather stations located between Madera and Kern counties are used to provide growers with daily citrus-specific forecasts. The Central Valley reports are updated twice daily in the morning and afternoon, and forecasts are also available for the Desert and Ventura region. The program will be providing frost information through March 15th. The WeatherWatch program can be accessed at cacitrusmutual.com. The Rural and Agriculture Council of America, as well as allied organizations, have penned a letter urging congressional leaders to extend several vital tax provisions. The letter emphasizes the economic significance of these provisions for rural America, including full expensing of investments in new equipment, which faces a phased reduction, expiring research and development tax incentives, and business deductions for interest expenses on earnings. The ag sector contributes nearly 1% to the U.S. GDP, and the organization stressed the importance of sustaining this with innovation and resiliency. The plea extends beyond agriculture, advocating for the extensions of other expiring tax incentives, emphasizing their impact on job opportunities, innovation, and community well-being. The letter also warns of potential negative consequences, such as outsourcing manufacturing jobs, if the noted tax provisions are allowed to lapse. A recent agribusiness trade mission has reportedly solidified a strong U.S. presence in Southeast Asia. A U.S. Department of Agriculture delegation led by USDA Undersecretary Alexis Taylor aimed to boost U.S. exports in Southeast Asia. During a week-long agribusiness trade mission in Malaysia and Singapore, more than 300 business-to-business meetings occurred. Taylor engaged in discussions with Malaysia's Ministry of Agriculture on various issues, including biotechnology cooperation, live cattle imports, and avian flu concerns. Climate change was a key focus with talks on Malaysia's participation in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. The mission highlighted a promising future for U.S. ag products in Southeast Asia, with local consumers expressing interest in high-quality U.S. offerings. Local businesses are looking to adopt U.S. ag practices, increasing demand for U.S. animal feed, genetics, and climate-smart agriculture methods. There are some concerns about how California is going to end up defining regenerative agriculture and how it relates to state programs. While at the Organic Grower Summit last week, VP of Environmental Science and Resources at Braga Fresh, Eric Morgan, spoke on a panel about how organic production practices will fit within the state's framework for regenerative.
For me, regenerative should start off with an organic basis, but I'm just not sure that that model will fit for every market in the country. I think for our market, that's what we need to focus on. And CDFA is working on defining that right now, and they are looking at allowing some level of gene modification or genetic engineering in. I don't know the other specifics, but for me, you know, for what I know and understand about regenerative, I really do think that it should maintain an organic focus, and that's what I'd advocate for sure.
Registration is open for the 2024 California Plant and Soil Conference. Hosted by the California chapter of the American Society of Agronomy, the 2024 conference will be held on February 6th and 7th at the DoubleTree Hotel in Fresno. The annual event provides an opportunity for students, professionals, and other attendees to increase their knowledge of important agronomic subjects in California. New items for the conference include a student mentor breakfast that will be held on Wednesday morning, and two additional sessions with six speakers will be offered in the afternoon after the business lunch. In addition to presentations on topics such as precision agriculture, nutrient management, and pesticide resistance, there will also be an award ceremony, a student poster competition, and non-competitive professional posters. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
As 2023 nears its completion, how does this year's wildfire season compare to previous years regarding acreage burned? Here's Rod Bain.
Just before the Thanksgiving holiday, separate fire complexes in the Mid-Atlantic region consumed over 16,000 acres in Virginia and North Carolina. Wildfires eventually contained by much-needed precipitation. Yet, as USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey points out, even with that significant November wildfire activity,
we are coming to the end of, at least on paper, one of the most quiet wildfire seasons that we have seen in a generation.
That assessment comes from National Interagency Fire Center numbers of U.S. wildfire acreage burned this year as of the end of November.
We have seen less than 2.6 million acres of vegetation burned in the United States so far in 2023.
If those numbers hold, 2023 would be the smallest annual wildfire acreage consumption since 1998.
A year that 1.3 million acres burned across the country.
As for the whys behind the quiet wildfire season this year in the western and central U.S.,
we had a truly remarkable winter of 2022-2023, record-setting precipitation and snowfall in the mountains, and that led to a late melt season and shortened the window of time that hillsides were exposed during the summer of 2023.
Combine that with a relatively cool summer out west, and much of the wildfire threat in that region was tamped down.
And that's where a lot of the acreage typically comes from. Take the west out of the equation, reduce the number of fires, the acreage, and that can really knock down those national numbers.
Wildfire activity in Alaska was also lower than in past years, contributing to the lower acreage burn totals nationwide. Rippey is quick to note contrast in the 2023 wildfire season, such as the quiet activity in the U.S. as a whole, with our nation's deadliest wildfire in a century, the Lahaina fire in Hawaii, which took place this year.
So even in what seems like a relatively quiet wildfire season, we can still have significant tragedy and deadly wildfires.
A second contrast, U.S. wildfire activity this year with what happened with our neighbors to the north.
Canada actually had a record wildfire season. Well over 40 million acres of mostly boreal forest burned in 2023 from the northern part of the country in British Columbia and the Northwest Territories all the way eastward to the Canadian Maritimes. We saw extensive wildfires affected air quality in the United States at various times.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Beekeepers across the nation face a common challenge during winter, helping bee colonies survive harsh conditions. Enter the Hive Hugger. Peggy DeSanto is the mastermind behind the award-winning Hive Hugger technology and says this all started with her love of nature and being a nurse. DeSanto explains how 55% of bee colonies are lost in the winter.
The average mortality for winter loss is there's about a 55% of northern climate beekeepers lose their bees every winter. And I just thought, wait a minute, we can do better. I went on a quest to build a high-tech and really effective, but even more so, it's science-based. You know, as a nurse, everything we do in medicine to save human lives is based in science. So as I went on this quest to save honeybee lives, it needed to be science-based. So I spent 2 years of doing research and then did a couple years of product development and then tested it out in the field.
Beekeepers can choose to either ventilate or not ventilate their hives in the winter, but DeSanto says the science behind her product is to not ventilate instead of letting moisture build.
Basically, it's two components, and for people who are really into beekeeping, there's sort of, do you ventilate to deal with moisture or not ventilate? And this is a non-ventilation system. It actually supports not having holes in the hive because there's too much heat loss, and so it's called a condensing hive, where this system encourages moisture to collect in the hive. But the key to sort of keeping that moisture from dripping down on your bees is you just need to super insulate the top of the hive. So the whole key to the design and the science says super insulate the top of the hive, keeps it above the dew point, keeps the bees dry. You also insulate the sides, but not as much, so that there's a differential, so that when the dew point is reached in the hive, that dew point, the condensation happens on the cooler walls.
The Hive Hugger is a non-ventilation design that preserves moisture while effectively insulating hives.
So the key components to the Hive Hugger, two pieces. The top panel is the most efficient insulation material on the planet ever made. 1 inch of this vacuum insulation panel is equal to like 10 inches of foam board. It's 10 times more efficient than any other insulation material. And the way it achieves that is by it's a vacuum panel. So think thermoses. The reason vacuums are really good insulators is in a vacuum, there's no air molecules. And without air molecules, there can be no heat transfer. And if there's no heat transfer, then heat's not leaving, you know, whatever's insulating it.
Different from other beekeeping tools, Hive Hugger prioritizes top insulation over side wraps.
A lot of the current insulation systems, for one, they mostly focus on the wraps, like the wall insulation, which is important to insulate there. But from what I've learned, and, you know, think about just how heat moves. Hot air goes up, cold air drops. And so the majority of the heat loss, whether it's your house or your body, is through the top. It's through the roof of the beehive. So if you're going to focus on one area to insulate, it really should be the top of the hive.
Preliminary studies in collaboration with the University of Minnesota Bee Lab showcase promising results.
I've been working, you know, in a collaborative effort with the University of Minnesota Bee Lab, and they told me about a SARE grant, which helped fund a pretty good research study. And there were COVID and other complicated factors that the grant wasn't fully completed, but at least the preliminary data we got last year, the Hive Hugger hives ran 15 to 50 degrees warmer than like tar paper hives or other sort of traditional ways of overwintering. And other studies I did even the year before that, the Hive Hugger hives, besides running significantly warmer, the bees consumed 30 to 50% less honey.
In northern climates, 55% of bee colonies die in the winter. The Hive Hugger has taken that down to 27%.
And so it's a 50% reduction in that mortality. So, I mean, that's significant. I mean, beekeepers know that there's tens of thousands of bees per single little hive box out in the field. And if we're losing over half of those every winter, that's a lot of bees if you do the math. And so if either through this hive hugger system or through education and beekeepers start realizing there's sort of an ideal way to winterize, and we start saving, the 55% mortality goes down to 27. That's a huge effect on the health and sort of future for our bees.
Hosting a holiday party can be stressful for the host, but sometimes even more stressful for the host's pets. Here's Gary Crawford.
Over the next few days, lots of people will be throwing lots of parties, all the way from huge blowout bashes down to small dinner parties. Now, if you have a dog or cat, either type party, and even just the extra holiday commotion and all,
can be stressful for our pets.
Kansas State University veterinarian Dr. Susan Nelson says some pets love it, others get really stressed out.
If your dog or your cat is not comfortable with strangers and other people in the house, then they should probably be shut up in a back room. Dogs maybe in their crate during the party time. That way they'll be less stressed and not in the midst of everything.
If you can't do that or you don't think it'll work, check ahead of time with your vet.
There's herbal supplements that can be safe and effective for mild stress to help with that. And then for ones who really get stressed and bothered, we can even look at some prescription medications if needed over the holidays.
Which will relieve your pet's stress and your stress too as pet owner and party host. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's interview segment.
Joined again this morning by our friends from Pinion Global, Tommy Irvin and Bill Hoover. And now, last time we spoke, we highlighted some of the most common questions you folks are fielding from industry members. And so today I wanted to get into the Farm Bill a little bit. And now, Tommy, I know you and the team over there have been providing some insight on some of the specialty crop needs within the Farm Bill. And so what have been some of the priority areas that maybe need some more support or have seen some success there in getting some helpful language included in Farm Bill discussions?
Yeah, you know, we get reached out to a lot, especially out of our Kansas offices. We have good relationships with some of the congressmen in Kansas who have participated in Farm Bill legislation in the past. So oftentimes it's around whether, you know, an AGI limitation makes sense. One example would be, you know, several programs allow for a higher payment limitation if a certain percentage of your income comes from farm income. So one thing on the permanent specialty crop that's pretty prevalent is an IC disc, which is an export benefit for farmers. And that dividend from the IC disc was not being included as farm income, even though it's really related to the farm. And so we push pretty hard along with a lot of others, and a lot of the trade associations, to get that included in that farm income definition, which it is now. They also added wages from a closely held C corporation, which previously wages weren't included in farm income. So they're always making changes and updating things as different business structures change, different things change. And we're just happy to be a part of those conversations ahead of time rather than after the fact and trying to get them fixed.
And now, in your experience, I was curious in what you've seen with this Farm Bill compared to maybe some of the previous ones. I know specialty crops have not always been front and center in some previous Farm Bill conversations. So does it seem like there's maybe some more receptiveness, or perhaps the specialty crop industry as a whole is maybe having its voice heard a little bit more compared to previous years?
I think so. I think it was pretty prevalent. You know, to take the World Ag Expo last year, huge presence from the Ag Committee there. So just the fact that many of them showed up, not just from California, but across the country, to have kind of a public forum and hear what the issues were for a lot of the people in the industries and several growers as well, you could tell that they were listening. Now it's just a matter of taking what they heard and putting it into action. So I do think that there's been more attention paid to the specialty crop industry than there has been in the past.
Yeah, that's certainly good news for specialty crop growers, maybe getting some more consideration there in the Farm Bill. And now moving over to Bill Hoover, manager for the business development team over at Pinion. You'd noted that there are some changes coming down the line that are going to be impacting farming operations as it pertains to estate planning. And so, Bill, what might industry members want to prepare for, or how might they want to go about those changes?
There's various estate planning limitations and thresholds that are going to be changing over the next 18 to 24 months. And so it's always a good idea to refresh and update estate planning, legacy planning for generational transfer of assets and wealth. And, you know, I think it's a good idea to reach out to your, you know, advisors to touch on that, especially in this time frame, because I think as we get closer to that deadline and the potential of a new administration coming in that may also modify some of those guidelines, you need to stay current on what those rules are and how it might impact your individual situation. And you know, I think farmers in general are not a big fan of sending checks off to the government. So
yeah, I'd say that's a pretty fair assessment there. So just a good idea in general to maybe start having those conversations now, making sure plans are set, and hopefully avoid any kind of potential problems down the line with those changes coming.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think you just don't want any surprises, and that's what we're here for. We try to help avoid those surprises and provide, you know, guidance and, you know, a path forward to help resolve any of those challenges.
Yeah. Now, just lastly here, some of the Pinion team is going to be out at the upcoming Almond Conference, available to field some questions from industry members, right?
Yeah, we'll have a booth. It's number 1429, and we'll be there. Tommy will be there, and we'll have some of our other specialty resources available to discuss any topic that might be on their mind. And we'll have some demonstration of our automated back office resource, which essentially automates the data entry portion for a farm operation into their bookkeeping system, and provides a lot of that analytical information that Tommy mentioned earlier around what are my costs per acre at this point in the season, which in a lot of the systems they're using today, you just don't have access to that information easily, and you're always trying to do it in the spreadsheet kind of outside the system. And we feel like we've really got a super tool to kind of keep a farm operation, keeping their information available and timely, so it's more useful.
Thank you, Brian. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news. Brazil's current round of soybean planting also includes some soybean harvesting. Dr. Michael Cardinier of Soybean and Corn Advisor, Inc. says the current harvest is 83% complete,
which is very slow, and in fact, they're harvesting and planting soybeans at the same time, which is very unusual. They started harvesting some soybeans in Mato Grosso last week. Now, these were soybeans planted on September 1st. These are cotton producers who were given permission to plant their soybeans a couple weeks earlier than normal. So it's a very small volume, but just the fact that they're already harvesting at the end of November is kind of unusual. What's left to plant is up in northeastern Brazil, where it's been dry, and way down in far southern Brazil, where it's been wet. So it's been a very slow end to Brazilian soybean planting.
He lowered his Brazil soybean harvest prediction by 1 million tons to 157 million. An even bigger story might be the second corn crop in Brazil.
I lowered that number 3 million tons today to 118. Everybody says they're going to plant less safrinha corn, reduce acreage at least 10 to 15%. Some people say 40 to 50%. And everybody says we're going to spend less on the safrinha corn crop because it's going to be planted late. The weather's kind of erratic, as it might be an early end to the summer rainy season. And corn prices are lackluster in Mato Grosso, so no one wants to risk very much on the safrinha corn.
He says the erratic differences in weather between the areas in Brazil is very unusual.
The last couple of years have been droughts. Droughts in southern Brazil, and last year Argentina had a historic drought, you know, the worst in like 60 years. And now this year in southern Brazil, extremely high amount of rainfall. So extremes in both parts of the country. Southern Brazil is getting like 3 to 4 times the normal rainfall. Whereas up in central Brazil, they're getting a fraction of the normal rainfall, at least up until about a week or two ago. It's getting better now, but it was very extreme in October and early November.
In Argentina, meanwhile, he says after a massive drought last year, the weather's improved.
The soybeans right now are 44% planted, corn 32%, both on the slow side, but it's improving. I think they are going to switch some intended corn acres over to soybeans because soybean prices are better.
One expert says USDA's new 2023 farm income forecast raises some concerns for 2024. Gary Crawford has more.
USDA says net cash farm income this year will be about 21% below last year's record high at just under $158 billion. However,
it's still above the long-term average.
And still leaves the farm sector in reasonably good shape this year. But USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer told me he's a little bit worried about 2024.
I'm an economist, and I'm a worrier. I always worry about these things.
And he gets paid to look into the future and, yes, to worry about it. And he says, first, for farm commodity prices,
we see prices coming down. So I do, again, continue to worry about margins that we'll achieve on the farm. So we might even expect a reversion to something smaller in terms of net farm income. You know, I might even just, from a momentum standpoint, anticipate some further declines.
But that's strictly unofficial. We'll get USDA's first official forecast for 2024 on February 7th, so mark your new calendars. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Ginny Pino-Gallagher, Director of Food and Agribusiness Practice at M3 Insurance, has seen cyber attack claims jump in the last 6 weeks among agribusiness. She says Google and Amazon were able to recently fight off the largest cyber attacks they've ever seen.
So this type of an attack is called a denial of service attack. It's a type of cyber attack targeting a specific application or website where the goal is to basically exhaust or overwhelm the target system's resources. They do this by sending multiple requests to the website at once. In fact, Google reported that when they became under attack back in August, at the peak, their system was receiving 398 million requests per second.
She says farmers should not feel that they are overlooked. Cyber criminals see farms as low-hanging fruit for easy financial gain. She advises businesses to talk to their insurer about cybercrime coverage and also to train employees and make passwords stronger.
What agribusinesses, what an individual farm, what an individual homeowner should be asking of their agent is, do we have coverage for a cyber attack? What does that coverage look like? Oftentimes, there might be like a throw-in coverage that's mixed in with either your homeowner's policy or your farm policy. But truly, if you want to have protection, you should look at a standalone cyber liability policy. They're very reasonably priced for the type of protection you get. And if the agent works a lot in this industry, they can actually help you build a protection plan, a preemptive plan to help control your risks and respond if you do have an attack.
She says cyber attacks can be incredibly disruptive to your business.
It can take an enormous amount of time to figure out what happened, how to recover your files. Backups are a very important thing, whether you have an individual farm or you have a large agribusiness. Backing up your information is really important. Training is always important, training your employees on how to identify these malicious emails, the fake emails, the phishing emails. I would say even at the family level, talk to your kids about cyber protection. I found a really interesting survey that was done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Researchers wanted to figure out, what do kids know about passwords? And the percentages of the respondents said that they use the same password for everything. That increased by age. By the time they got to high school age, 87% said they use the same password for every platform.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.